Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, coming to you each and every Sunday here on News Talk 580 KMJ. Each week, we visit with Valley veterans of World War II, and the purpose behind that is really threefold. First of all, we want to honor the men and women who served our country when our country needed them the most. Second of all, we want to preserve those stories for posterity and to educate the future generations of Americans, and also to inspire those of us in my generation and generations to come to live up to the legacy left by the greatest generation. And I do want to remind you, before we get started with the meat of the program today, I want to remind you about the big concert coming up September 14th at the Saroyan Theater in downtown Fresno. This is a free concert at 2 o'clock. They will be accepting donations to support our returning troops serving overseas right now. This benefit concert put on by the Sounds of Freedom Band, a local band made up of veterans and also some young people. You look at the band and you see people from age 13 or 14 all the way to 90 years old. And it is a great band that will be playing some wonderful military and patriotic music on September 14th at 2 o'clock at the Saroyan Theater. So I just wanted to remind you about that. And now, to introduce our guest this week, you might remember him from his 42 years writing for the Fresno Bee. And in fact, some would say that he still has the best material in the Bee sometimes, because he's a frequent contributor to the letters to the editor page. And I understand he wants to introduce himself in Serbian today. So let's see if you can understand this.
Moje ime je Ilija Sretenčić. Ne znam što ću drugo kazat.
My name is Ilija Sretenčić, and what?
I don't know what else to tell you.
Fair enough. I wouldn't understand it anyway. Now, Ilija, you grew up in Sanger, on Apache. And,
on a farm.
On a farm, picking figs?
Picking figs, muscat, grapes, peaches.
And you obviously knew that something was going on in the world, that there was some conflict brewing. You'd heard about what Hitler was doing in Germany. But I understand that when the day that the U.S. was drawn into the war, the attacks on Pearl Harbor, the Sunday morning, December 7th, 1941, you were doing something I like to do. You're playing a little basketball, is that right?
Playing basketball. I had moved to Oakland after being graduated from Sanger High, and I worked had a job in a furniture store there, and we were playing basketball on that Sunday morning in Mosswood Park, right off of Broadway and 38th Street, I think it was, or is, right near where Kaiser Permanente started his operation.
So did you finish the game, or was this such a big news flash that that was the end of it?
We didn't know anything about it till we got home, where I was living with his friends of mine, and they told us that Pearl Harbor had been bombed. We didn't know Pearl Harbor from Pearl Bailey.
But you would learn about it soon enough, and I guess you realized that you were going to have to serve at one point or another?
You bet. I just turned 17. Yeah. And everybody else was being called up, and finally I decided I better sign up before they called me, so I signed up with the Air Corps, Army Air Corps.
I think you told me once before that you wanted to be a Marine.
I was so anxious to leave my work, I get out of the working and go to join everybody else. I try to get my dad to sign to let me go to the Marines, but he didn't wisely. So there I was, waiting to be called for cadet training.
What do you think you'd be doing if you had gone into the Marines?
Pushing up daisies probably somewhere.
Good chance of that, given the casualty rates. Not that serving in the Army Air Corps, especially as a pilot, was a necessarily safe job. I know you lost too many friends to think otherwise from that. Had you ever flown before, thought about flying?
I used to marvel at the idea of airplanes, and I loved those old movies with Richard Dix and whoever else, Errol Flynn, I guess. And I used to build models that I never finished of airplanes. But I never flew. I'd never flown till I got to primary training in Ontario, California.
What did that feel like the first time you went up. I'm sure that's something that every pilot remembers, that first rush of, I'm actually doing this. I'm up in the air.
Well, the flying with the instructor wasn't too bad because he was in charge most of the time. But once you got your 8 hours and you went up solo, that's when you looked down and you wondered, what the heck am I doing up here? Lovely orange groves down there in the Pomona and around that area. And you're wondering, what the heck you doing? But I got it back down.
Well, it kind of reminds me of a quote that the late, great Dutch Warmerdam shared with me one time. Of course, the greatest pole vaulter of all time. First got to go 15 feet and to do it with a bamboo pole. And, of course, from the valley, grew up near Hanford. He always said that getting up wasn't the problem, but getting down was awfully hard. And I guess that's true for a young pilot just trying to learn his wings a little bit.
You hold your breath.
Now, the first plane that you actually got to fly on a mission was called the Apache. That's pretty coincidental.
It certainly is, an A-36. It was a P-51, the early P-51 Mustang. It came equipped with dive brakes in it so that you could dive bomb with it. And that was my first fighter after getting out of Luke Field and getting my wings.
Did that mean anything to you? Did you get a kick out of the fact that here you are an Apache flying an Apache?
I did, I guess, but they eventually changed the name to the Invader, so it was Apache just for a short time, then became the Invader.
Well, that's why you had to switch to P-47.
Exactly.
What was that like? Here you are, still a young man, and you're flying this expensive piece of equipment. People are shooting at you. What do you remember about your first mission, and what did that feel like?
Well, I don't know. You kind of put yourself in the hands of your flight leader, and I had excellent leaders, Jackson Saunders mainly, and I remember the first mission. Well, we checked out in the 36. I had never flown one before. The last airplane I'd flown was the AT-6 in advanced flying school. And I got in the A-36, and it was like getting into a Cadillac. You know, you're flying around Mount Etna there and watching the volcano explode around Naples. And I guess it took a couple of turns around the field, and then next thing you know, you're flying up your first mission. And the first one was around Monte Cassino. And that's where I first saw these little puffs of black coming around toward us, and I was wondering, what the hell is going on here? And Saunders kept yelling, "Jink, move around, number two." You know, it was flak, and I never realized, no one had told me what flak looks like.
You thought a black puff of smoke wasn't going to hurt you?
I didn't know what it was. I was just young and dumb.
I can imagine what the sights must have been for you. Obviously, getting shot at is no one's dream. But I've seen the pictures of Monte Cassino and the story behind the monastery on top of the hill there. And just to be in that situation at that point, it seems to me like it would have been somewhat surreal.
I guess it was. I really don't recall it that vividly. I remember the flak, and I forget what we were strafing, probably somewhere around there, whoever was resupplying the people that were holding on to Cassino, probably the trucks and whatever. And I don't think I had a hole in the plane that time.
I was just going to say, you saw the black puffs of smoke. When was the first time that you figured out what that felt like when you got hit by the plane?
Well, the A-36 was very vulnerable, so you try to avoid all kind of flak if you could. And it was fast, and you could get out of the way hurriedly. And I don't remember getting hit too much in the A-36, but in the P-47, you were always being shot at and hit.
Now, you flew, was it about 20 missions or 30 in an A-36?
Somewhere in the 20s, I'm not sure exactly.
And then word came that you guys were going to get this new plane,
right?
The P-47.
The other squadron was flying P-40s, and I think they got their P-47s just a couple of days before we got ours, and just all of a sudden we're in this new airplane.
And this was the 526th Fighter Bomber Squadron of the 86th Fighter Group that was headquartered there in Italy at the time.
Right.
First time you saw a P-47, and you saw the shape of it.
Nobody wanted to fly the big monster. It was just too big. It had the radial engine. It was just, after flying that 51, which is like a sports plane, you know, a 436, a P-51, it was like driving a sports car and going into something different.
Like giving up a Corvette for a minivan?
Yeah, something like that, except I have nothing bad to say about the P-47. It was a beautiful airplane. That could do everything that the A-36 did, probably.
So it didn't take you too long to get used to it?
Not at all.
When some people call the P-47 a jug, I've heard some P-47 pilots say, I don't like it when they call it a jug. It sounds demeaning to me. How do you feel about that?
It doesn't matter to me, but I remember when I was in the Air National Guard out here, General Smith flew, and he was an ace out of England, out of flying P-47s, and he just hated it being called a jug, but it didn't bother me.
Just as long as it brought you home.
47, Thunderbolt.
P-47 Thunderbolt treated you pretty well.
Yes,
well, I think it's about time for our first commercial break, but when we come back, we'll hear about some of the adventures that Eli Setensich had in a P-47 over Europe, how many missions he flew, and that number might make you bat your eyelashes a little bit. Much more to come on this edition of Hometown Heroes. We'll be right back with Eli Setensich on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Wild Blue Yonder, performed there by the Sounds of Freedom Band, which you can catch in concert. It's free September 14th at Saroyan Theater in downtown Fresno. That's at 2 o'clock, and they will welcome your donations to support our returning troops who have been fighting all over the world to preserve our freedom, just like Eli Setensich did during World War II when he was a P-47 pilot, first an A-36 pilot, then a P-47 Thunderbolt pilot, with the 526th Fighter Bomber Squadron of the 86th Fighter Group over Italy. And one thing that's really neat, it's funny how you go through and every different unit in World War II had a history, but not all of that has been preserved, and not much of it is online. But one thing that your group has done is actually put all the war diaries that were kept online. So I was actually able to dig up a little dirt on you here. And, you know, the first time when I had you on TV, Eli, talking about your service during World War II, we did a whole interview, and I was really thrilled at some of the great stories that you told me. And then left and put the story together, and then I think I spoke to you maybe an hour before it was about to air, and you mentioned that you had also earned two Distinguished Flying Crosses. And I was so upset that I had not gotten that out of you in the initial interview. So that's one thing I want to make sure to do in this program today, is hear a little bit about that. And I know that one of those Distinguished Flying Crosses came on a time where you thought you might not be making it back. Your P-47, which could take a bit of a beating, got hit near the Black Forest. Is that right?
As I recall, that was a long time ago, Paul.
Oh, come on. Your memory,
yeah,
sir.
Yeah, well, anyway, I think it was a four-ship flight, and I was leading it, and we hit a train somewhere outside Krailsheim, I think it was, which is in the near the Black Forest area of Germany. Next thing you know, I hear this big thump, and flames are shooting out of the right side of my plane. And I kick, release, we're right on the deck, obviously, and I flip the switch to get rid of the canopy, and it flies off, and I see the flames coming and oil and all this junk, so I turn off the switch of the airplane, figure I'm going to land it somewhere, but I see nothing but trees under me. And I say, the heck with it. I turned it back on, and good old 18 cylinders kicked over. I don't know how many were running then, but the old 47 would run on half its cylinders. And sure enough, we got away, but it must have been a train that carried it was a flak train, probably had one of the cars that just opened up, and they started shooting 20 millimeters at us.
Was that something where you could see the flak coming and tried to dodge it, or you didn't know it was coming when you got hit?
We had no idea. We were fat and sassy. We were coming in on the deck and shooting up this train. Next thing you know, I was the only one who was hit of the four people in the flight, so it wasn't my turn.
How much time do you think elapsed from the time that you turned those engines off, which put out the fire, to when you tried to kick it back in? Were you coasting for a while? Did you have some time to try to figure this out and evaluate your options?
God, if I can't remember. Couldn't have been more than 10, 15 seconds, if that.
Were you thinking I might have to
bail out? Yeah, but it was just too low to bail out, probably. Although we were taught, we had a squadron commander named Bill Benedict, who was a wild man and flew with the RCAF before he took over our squadron. And he taught us to bail out at low levels. All you had to do is kick your canopy off and dial your trim all the way to forward, pull up on the stick, and then hammer the stick, and it'll just pop you out of the airplane like a toaster would pop a piece of bread. And it worked for some of the guys.
But you weren't dying to try it.
I wasn't trying to try it, and I thought it was too low anyway. So
you didn't have a whole lot of options, especially if you were going to make it.
I suppose not. Mm-hmm. If I had to do it again, I'd probably do the same thing.
In that time were you sure that shutting off the engine was going to put out the fire?
I think I'd heard that somewhere. I don't know whether it put out the fire or the fire just burned itself out, but the engine, I don't know whether I heard the plane was liable to blow up with the engine on fire. I don't know what it was, but I turned it off. It's goofy.
And then you fire it back up and it catches,
yep.
And you make it on home.
Then stagger home.
What'd the plane look like when you got back?
Pretty black on one side. I think it was the right side. I was happy to get back.
Well, I imagine with the canopy off, too, you might have looked a little black yourself.
Yeah, I think I was okay.
Did that, when you sat in bed that night after that mission and that close of a call, is that something that kind of gets your attention, something you reflect on and say a little prayer of thanks about, or you just try to forget about it?
Oh, it's over. It's just like beating a train through a crossing. It's over, you know. You don't think about it. I don't wake up in a sweat, that's for sure, or never have.
142 missions?
Yeah.
That's a lot.
They weren't, none of them were really too long. I think maybe the longest one was like 4 hours. Maybe we did a 6-hour one sometimes if we were escorting somebody. We did a couple of escort missions of like B-25s and B-26s. Most of them were close support. You were working with the ground troops, just ahead of them, trying to knock out tanks or whoever they're facing.
Did you have a routine before every mission? I realize you got your instructions and you knew what you had to do, but did you have a kind of a personal routine that you would go through to prepare yourself for entering a situation like that?
I kiss my crew chief on the lips every time.
Is he still around to verify that point?
No, but you had to trust him. He and the parachute rigger are the most important guys in the outfit, and they kept the planes going.
What was the camaraderie like between guys on the crew or all the pilots, everybody around there?
I think it was very close. Very, very close. And the longer you stayed, the closer it was. Although there were competitions too, you know, how many missions you got and how many planes you might have shot up on some runway, and who could make the tightest pattern landing. That was always a competition. Sometimes it ended up in a catastrophe. One guy just spun in and killed himself.
Just trying to get one up on everybody else?
Yeah, I guess.
I was going to ask you that, too. When every time that you guys out, and you were averaging a mission a day for a long time out there, so often, I'm sure you'd come back and you find out that not everybody came back.
True.
Did that get to you? Did that make you think someday it's going to be me?
Well, this never thought about it being me, I don't think, because you were invincible. You're 20 years old. You know, nobody's going to hurt you. But when Jackson Saunders went down, that really hit home. Not so much that it about myself, but they're just losing him, and it turned out he's a POW. And then the next guy that I went overseas with, Jim Sturman, He was shot down and also captured and sent to some Stalag. So I got to see them both after the war. So, no, and he lost some, and you just went on to the next day. You never thought about it, I don't think. Maybe it affected other people differently, I don't know.
When you hear those stories, and when you think back of the pilots that you knew who went down and never came back, or the guys like you just mentioned who became prisoners of war, and you understand everything that they went to, and the starvation, and in some cases the inhumane treatment, how thankful does that make you for the way your story turned out?
Oh, very much so. Although it'd been interesting to be a POW, I suppose, at least for a couple of days.
You must have enjoyed Hogan's Heroes, if you say
that. Oh, yeah, definitely. And Stalag 17.
Been a lot of good in The Great Escape, of course.
Yeah.
Great movie. And there are a lot of prisoners of war around here who can identify with
I'm sure.
So many of those stories. Tell you what, we're going to catch our next commercial break here. When we come back, more of the exploits of Eli Setensich in the cockpit of his P-47 over Europe during World War II with 142 missions. You can bet there are a few more that would be pretty close calls. So we're going to hear some stories about that. Also, talk a little bit about one of his good friends in the war who might be a face that some of you might remember. And also, I'm going to dig up some of the dirt that I found online on Eli and some of the things that there is written proof of him doing for our U.S. Army Air Corps during World War II. We'll be right back with more of Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Tell us about your hometown hero. Email your story by clicking on the Hometown Heroes link at KMJ580.com.
It's been a long, long time. That's the Harry James Orchestra, and it has been a long, long time since Eli Setensich was one of the youngest captains in the U.S. Army Air Corps during World War II. Since then, you may have read an article or a column or two in the Fresno Bee with his byline on it. Still see him pop up in those letters to the editor with his sometimes biting wit. And today, he's sharing some memories with us from his time in the service during World War II. And doing a little digging here, Eli, I came up with a couple notes in the war diary of your division. You had a couple big days in March of 1945, big enough to get written up by your division officer here. I'm just going to read this for our listeners, then you can fill us in a little bit. It says, on March 20th, 1945, Captain Eli J. Setensich led an 8-plane formation of fighter bombers on an armed reconnaissance of the battle area with a close support mission to be assigned as the primary target. On arriving at the target area, the flight was assigned the task of conducting a reconnaissance from Neustadt to Mannheim. They were unable to find any movement. Controller then called them and told them there was motor transport movement southwest of Kaiserslautern. On arriving at the area, the flight could see our own troops advancing southeast out of the town and the Germans moving east about 4 or 5 miles away from our troops. Immediately attacking, the flight bombed and strafed the fleeing enemy, destroying or damaging 47 enemy motor transports and 7 horse-drawn vehicles. Now, hopefully that refreshes your memory a little bit about March 20th, 1945. First of all, for a knucklehead like me who wouldn't necessarily know from the cockpit of a P-47 how to tell the difference, what told you which was the Americans and which was the Germans? Was it their vehicles, some markings? What told you the difference between the Americans and the Germans there?
The swastikas.
You could see them from the air?
Sometimes. I don't know. We were looking for old ladies in wheelchairs mainly, and just kidding, Paul.
Your sense of humor sometimes.
But you knew if they directed you. Usually, we worked with somebody called Rover Joe on the bomb line, and wherever they directed you, one of our pilots also served. You'd fly in a little Piper Cub and go up and down the lines, looking to see where the enemy was, and he would direct you, and you'd go in and strafe the tank or the truck or whatever it happens to be, and that was the best thing that I can think of, is getting a report back from the ground troops saying that we did a good job, and we get those now and then. That we hit the target really well when they were on the move up the either whether it was in Germany or in Italy or France or wherever it was.
I imagine that would mean something because, in essence, when you're knocking out tanks, machinery, vehicles, artillery, the idea is you're saving the lives of some of those guys on the ground. That's something they're not going to run into.
That's what we hope to do, yeah.
Was there a trick? How long did it take you to try to get the feel of where you're aiming and where what you're shooting is actually going? Did that take you a while to get used to? Did weather conditions change how that would happen?
Oh, definitely. The weather would change. If it were foggy or you were flying over the overcast, you couldn't see your target naturally. But you had tracers. What sequence it was, but you'd have tracers, and you could. That would help you aim, and you had your little what do you call it? I don't even know now. Your gun sight right in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
So you could tell pretty good what you're doing. Dive bombing was a totally different thing. You had to just go pretty much by feel. And you just either skip bomb or dive bomb. When they told us dive bombing made you sterile or gave you hemorrhoids, so I tried to avoid that. That was just a rumor.
Good to know the verdict on that one. Now, right after I came across that note, and you put these two dates together, and it's one day after the other. In that same war diary of the 526th Fighter Bomber Squadron of the 86th Fighter Group, it says, on March 21st, 1945, Captain Eli J. Settensich led a nine-plane formation of fighter bombers in an attack upon fortified positions on the northwest side of the hill near the town of Fishback. Our troops were being held up by these positions. Good weather made the probability of the mission being successful good. On arriving at the target area, Captain Settensich immediately formed his flight for the attack and led them in a perfect bombing run, putting all the bombs in the target area. Dugout positions and entrenchments were well covered, and four strafing passes were made. At the time of the attack, friendly elements were only 1,000 yards south of the target. The next day, a letter of commendation was received from the 42nd Infantry Division. The letter read in part, "Seasoned veterans state air attack was best close support ever witnessed. Grateful is a weak word for a division's feelings." So that's kind of what you just described. When you hear from the guys on the ground, you did a good job. And they're saying here, you did a perfect job because if you were a football field or two off, you might have killed us.
Yeah, that's just the way I wrote that.
Yeah, I don't think you can take credit for this one.
That gave you a good feeling that you did some good with your bombs and your bullets.
And what that tells me is that's a tough situation to be in when you know that if you're not perfect, you might kill your own men.
Yeah, and it happened. There were some terrible, especially down in Sicily. I remember that lost a lot to friendly fire from aircraft. But luckily, it never happened to me, and not into my outfit, as far as I know.
Well, it's certainly a dangerous situation for all involved. And the other thing I noted, just in reading that account of it, talks about you and the eight other planes in that formation taking four strafing passes. And I would think the first pass you make, it's not a secret anymore. They know where you are. They know where you're going to be. Did each successive pass? Did it become fraught with more danger and bring more fire from the ground?
I don't remember.
I mean, would that be a typical situation where the longer you're there, the greater the chance of you getting hit?
Unless you got them so much on the run, they don't have, or you knock out their flak guns. You know, we did a lot of flak suppression work for higher, you know, for the bombers that came through. You know, a lot of times we'd hit them early, but. You're only worried about the tail end Charlie. He was the guy that got the worst of it, you know.
Well, and I'm sure if you flew 142 missions, you had to have been tail end Charlie once or twice.
Oh, yeah, of course. You know, you start out as a wingman, and then they go home, and then you become a leader, or they get shot down, and you start leading flights.
Now, I mentioned that you received two Distinguished Flying Crosses, and we talked a little bit about why. But your unit, the 86th, also got two presidential unit citations. One was in April of 1945 when you hit airfields in northern Germany. Another one had been in 1944 when the Germans were trying to stop the Allies from getting to Rome, but could not. Does it mean more to you to have those two distinguished flying crosses, or to know that that all the guys you served with in the 86th received those presidential unit citations?
Oh, the latter, no question about it, because everybody got a distinguished flying cross sooner or later.
That's a slight exaggeration.
Well, slight, but getting a unit citation, it showed that the outfit produced and did, the morale was good, and that we did what we were called upon to do and did it.
I understand that that you had an encounter at one point with Hap Arnold, who was the it guy in the Air Corps at that time.
Yeah.
You bumped into him in Rome, is that right?
Right. I think we were on a rest and recuperation every now and then. After you flew a certain number of missions, your flight would, or a couple of flights would go to, we had a hotel in Rome that we'd go to right on the Via Veneto, is that it?
Mm-hmm.
I forget the name of the hotel, but I was just sitting there in the lobby one day, dreamily, or reading the paper, and here comes this entourage, and there's Hap Arnold. I didn't have the sense to even get up, but he asked me how things are going. I said, fine. He went on to the next lunatic sitting there.
You mean you didn't stand and salute?
I was too dumbfounded, I guess.
But you got away with it.
Got away with it.
Which is good news.
No one else jumped at their feet, as I recall, anyway. He was very casual about it. And from all accounts, he was a very regular guy, anyway.
When do you remember the first time that you saw Rome after it had been liberated, and what that was like? Did, being an American serviceman in Rome, did you get some attention from the people there? Was it a warm reception?
Yeah. We I don't know. There was a couple of, we just hit the bars mainly. There's Broadway Joe's, one of them that we were, you'd always hang out in that if you spend much time in the town. And I remember this one fellow I mentioned, Jim Sturman, a short little bulldog of a guy. If he'd see two young Italian dandies walking down the street hand in hand or however they were, he was determined to go through them for some reason or other. He was just a nasty-minded little guy. But most of all, we got along with him. The girls were friendly.
Mm-hmm.
Don't tell my wife.
Well, she might be listening, so the cat might be out of the bag on that. This was a long time ago.
Send her out of the room.
20-year-old kid in Italy during World War II. What else did that 20-year-old kid experience, and what face from modern television might you recognize that was a gentleman that Eli served with during World War II? We'll talk about that and one more close call that we have to cover, as well as what he's been doing since then. Not that we can cover all that ground, but we're going to try when Hometown Heroes comes down the home stretch with Eli Setensich today on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Heard that in a while either, have you? That, of course, is There Are Such Things, Tommy Dorsey and Frank Sinatra. You may have heard of those two gentlemen, and you may have heard of Eli Setensich, who spent more than four decades writing for the Fresno Bee. You might remember him from television and radio before that. And he has been around these parts for a long time, a Sanger High School graduate, and yes, a Cal Bears fan. Also spent some time playing football at Visalia College. And who was your coach over there, Eli?
Peter Biden.
The late, great Pete Biden.
A wonderful guy.
He's wearing a pretty big smile right about now, don't you think?
He is. He had to know.
The Diamond Dogs are national champions, of course. But, yeah, Pete Biden, football coach of Visalia College. What position did you play, Eli?
I played end, iron hand end.
Iron Hand in, huh?
Dropped all the passes were thrown to me.
We'd expect nothing less from you. If only you could have dropped that bomb, though, when you came back from a mission in Europe during World War II. Let's talk about that a little bit. Now, every mission, you'd go off with bombs.
Right.
And usually you had two of them, is that right?
Two of them, one on each, under each wing. 500-pounders, usually sometimes 1,000-pounders, but that was very rare.
And once those things are armed, you want to make sure you let them go. You don't want to be landing with the bomb still on the plane.
Definitely.
So tell us what happened.
Well, we were stationed in Corsica at the time and flying missions on the boot in Italy. And I forget what the target was, but evidently my one bomb wouldn't release. And it was either the left or right, I don't know which one. No matter what I did, I'd make pass after pass and pull this switch and this, and nothing happened. So we turned around and came home. And I found out later it was a policy of the outfit that you're supposed to bail out and drop, not risk bombing the airfield or having the bomb drop on your commanding officer or something.
Sacrifice the plane as opposed to maybe losing everybody.
Right. Uh-huh. So I pretended I didn't know or just came home anyway and landed it, and the bomb, smoothest landing I ever made, I'm sure.
I'm sure you're a little nervous landing that thing.
And the bomb squirted off just as I touched down and bounced behind me and went off, and nobody was hurt. And no one yelled at me either, as I remember. But I was glad it was over.
How close would you say you were to the explosion? How far away were you by the time that it went off?
I couldn't even feel the concussion, if I remember correctly. So it must have bounced a few times and then hit on the nose or something and then went off. It had to be 100 yards or 50 yards at the most, at the shortest.
You make this sound like it wasn't a big deal, but I'm sure it scared the whatever out of you at the time.
Not so much, really. It was just part of the day, I guess, or part of the war.
Another adventure. 142 missions in the air over Europe during World War II, two Distinguished Flying Crosses, and also a friend who, at that time, you never would have imagined sitting in your living room and watching him on the Newhart Show. Tell me about Tom Poston, how you came to know him and what kind of guy he was.
We met in a brothel in Algiers. We were both lost. No, we were in flying school together.
Yes, that first one was a joke.
Joke.
In case you're listening, anymore.
We were in advanced training at Luke Field in Arizona, out of Phoenix, and we became great buddies. We played basketball together there, and in fact, our little team was beating everybody. Tom was quite an athlete, and we caroused in town. We got off the base, and we went overseas together. There were 100 of us. Misfits, I guess. They didn't know what to do with us, so they sent us all together on a train. We went to Newport News, and from there on a converted Japanese liner, the Empress of Japan, took us to Casablanca. And Tom and I were together all the way through and into Sicily, where we were first sent to. They didn't know what to do with us, so they sent us to a troop carrier outfit, and we stayed in that for a while. And little by little, first it was Jack Saunders, then Jim Sturman and Bob Taft, different guys that were in the outfit, all got into the 86th Fighter Group, and I got into it, and Tom never made it. Tom stayed with troop carriers, and he ended up flying paratroopers on D-Day in England, out of England. And then we connected up again after the war and were friends until he died.
So you guys... You formed such a strong bond during those early times that you
became great friends. In fact, it was funny. I was watching TV, and I forget what year it was, and there's a Steve Allen show, and I looked when he did this man on the street routine, and I said, that's Tom, for God's sakes. and I hadn't seen him in, 10 years maybe, not, 45 to, must have been around the early 50s. So we got in touch with each other. Then we saw him once in New York when he and his wife Kay were living back there. And then when he moved to the West Coast, to L.A., we'd see him every now and then. Became became very close friends. It was a big loss when he died.
Sounds like the real-life Tom Poston was, quite a contrast to the character he played on TV.
He was the warmest human being that you could imagine. He was just a sweet man, very caring, loved his kids. Could get pretty nasty sometimes, but overall he was a very kind and loving person. He'd have to be to, like me.
You've got the zingers left and right against yourself. I'll tell you, there's some good ones out there. We've still got a few minutes left on the show. Tell me about coming home from the war. 142 missions. Now, you did get to come home for Christmas 1944, when the guys who were still back there were dealing with that same kind of weather that all of our Battle of the Bulge survivors tell us about. But after 142 missions, you finally get to come home. What was that like for you? How excited were you to get back here?
Well, I had every reason to believe that we'd end up in the Far East.
Mm-hmm.
And I just kept waiting to hear from somebody. I went back to Oakland, as I recall, and then I remember walking down the street in Oakland and seeing the Oakland Tribune. It was extra. Atom bomb dropped, and I didn't know what the hell that meant, how atom bomb. I'd never heard of such a thing. I thought our little 500-pounders were the main bombs. And it turns out the surrender followed that immediately in August, whatever that was. Next thing you know, I'm separated and looking for work.
And
looking for honest work.
You never found that, did you?
Never did. I went into journalism. Could have become a banker or a shoe salesman, I guess.
I couldn't resist teeing that one up for you. How did you end up? I know you worked in radio and television a little bit before you ended up at the Fresno Bee, but obviously you liked that a little bit if you stayed there 42 years. Is that something that you enjoyed, to get around the community and learn about things that maybe you hadn't been familiar with and tell these stories that you thought people ought to hear?
Inertia, really. I couldn't move, and it was easy. It wasn't work. I loved it. It was really, to be honest with you, except for an editor here or there, which I won't talk about.
No naming names there. You miss it?
I do every now and then, but then I don't. With the gasoline prices of what they are, I was driving back and forth to Sanger. I'd have to get a night job to go with it.
And you, if you ever need to vent a little bit, you just write a letter to the editor.
Right.
And you do a very good job of that.
And sometimes they print them, sometimes they don't.
Well, maybe you can share some of the ones they haven't printed with us at some point. But for the rest of the time today, I do want to ask you, when you think back, and you talked about Tom Poston, and just listening to you talk about him, the respect and admiration you have for him as a person, knowing the things that he went through is evident. When you think about all the guys that you served with in the 86th, and even the broader picture of the men and women who were serving our country during that time, what do you think is the one most important thing that people today need to understand and remember and always hold on to about people like you and what you did during World War II?
Will you repeat that question?
No. Might take me a minute.
Oh, I don't know. We were so young, and we were just out of a depression. You wanted to get away and you see the world. And people went to the Navy. Others did what I did. And then the poor souls that fought on the ground, they're the ones that deserve all the credit. My gosh. But it was a great experience. I wouldn't want to call it the defining moment of your life, but I'm glad I did it and survived it.
When's the last time you flew an airplane?
I flew one, actually. Well, I took a ride to F-16 with the Air Guard here a couple of years when I was still working, and he let me fly a little bit from the back seat. And I pulled about 6 G's, and I said, forget it, that's enough for me.
A little more juice than a P-47,
Lord.
Huh?
It was beautiful, though.
Well, those are some great memories. I know you spent some time flying with the Air National Guard here and got to know some other great men and great friends through that. And I know there are a lot of your friends that are listening today and enjoy hearing you talk about this, because I know it's not something that you always volunteer. It's not something you ever want to brag about, but it's important to share it. And we're better for hearing about your experiences during World War II. So thank you for serving our country, and thank you for the example you set for the rest of us. And keep writing those letters to the editor so we can get a chuckle here and there.
Well, thank you, Paul, for inviting me. It's very nice of you, and I hope you edit this thing so all the slurring is gone out of it. And
Well, I'd take all the fun out of it if I started editing, so we'll leave it at is, as is. And that is our program for today. Eli Setensich, our guest, will be back with another edition of Hometown Heroes next Sunday at 4 on News Talk 580 KMJ.